Now, the one who protects us all from prattling prognosticators and perfidious pundits.
I say, America, stay out the bushes.
Look for the union label.
And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government.
From my cold, dead hands.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
It's time for the Alan Nathan Show. Here he is, the longest-running nationally syndicated centrist host in the country, Alan Nathan.
Welcome, everyone, to the Alan Nathan Show, the home of militant moderation, where we live by Alan's mantra, we want the Republicans out of our bedrooms, the Democrats out of our wallets, and both out of our First and Second Amendment rights. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News, your host today. Please be sure to visit our website at alannathan.com for our podcasts and our show times. Have you noticed that Jeffrey Epstein is suddenly back in the news? Out of nowhere, like a bolt from the blue, suddenly the news is ablaze with Jeffrey Epstein revelations and with a lot of stories that were suddenly hastily retracted. Stories canceled, tweets deleted, messages from the Democratic National Committee that suddenly vanished. This is all solely and entirely, it might seem confusing to you, but it's actually very simple. The Democrats know that the shutdown was a debacle for them, and their spin effort to try to make it sound like the shutdown was a huge success and they got everybody talking about their issues and everything is great is not working. They're not fooling anybody. They're not even fooling themselves about the shutdown. And so the word went out to their loyal media that the subject must be changed immediately. And the Democrats decided to change it by coming up with Jeffrey Epstein news, and once again, to revive the idea that Donald Trump was somehow uniquely connected to Epstein and was one of his clients for underage sex and whatever other nefarious things they could pin on him. So they hastily tried to cook up a story, but they didn't cook it well enough. It was a very undercooked dish that they served up for the media, because they tried to make it sound like some shocking new revelation had been dumped, and that it was some as-yet unknown witness, somebody we never heard from before, some mystery woman, had come forward and implicated Trump somehow in having a close relationship with Epstein. But that didn't work. And one of the big reasons it didn't work is that the Republicans in Congress, moving with a speed and ruthlessness that is quite unlike them, honestly, but they were on the ball this time, they immediately ran out and declassified a whole bunch of Epstein documents that made it clear this mystery woman was well known. It was Victoria Jeffrey, who tragically committed suicide some time ago, and she had already cleared Trump of all wrongdoing. In her opinion, Trump had nothing to do with Epstein. He didn't like him. He threw him out of Mar-a-Lago for trying to recruit underage girls for whatever weird sex ring Jeffrey Epstein was running. So she was already essentially a friendly witness to Donald Trump, and nothing that was being built here was actually new or shocking or a revelation. But the Republicans kept going, and some of the documents that they declassified about Epstein and put out there yesterday actually implicate an entirely different politician, and his name is Barack Hussein Obama. So some of these new Epstein documents are discussions that Epstein was having where he was talking about Obama being a friend of his and coming out and meeting with him in Palm Beach and going golfing with him. And all of a sudden, man, this story is radioactive. The story they were trying to push so hard 24 hours ago to distract from the shutdown disaster is now being buried in a lead-lined vault in the desert like it was nuclear waste, because Barack Obama is suddenly part of the story, and other Democrats as well. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein is a bizarre character, and the Jeffrey Epstein story is lurid. You know, it captures people's attention because it's got sex and underage girls and a lot of money involved in it. So boy, this is the kind of story people just eat up. They love this stuff. But it's such a big, complicated scandal for everyone involved, because a lot of Democrats were involved with him, a lot of Republicans were involved with him, and a lot of the people that were involved with him weren't really that involved. I mean, he was all over the place. The guy was a bon vivant, and he was making a point of getting in touch with powerful people, getting photographed with them, you know, building relations with them. And you know, it's pretty obvious he was running some kind of a blackmail influence operation, whatever he was doing down there. We still don't really know. I mean, there's so much about the Jeffrey Epstein story that we really don't know. Hillary Clinton popped up in the latest Epstein documents, too. There's some stuff about her and about her staff in there that's a little uncomfortable for the Democrats. So that's another reason why they're going to bury this thing in cement somewhere, because it's not what they want it to be. They desperately want this to become entirely a story about Trump being a pedophile or what have you, or being in league with Jeffrey Epstein. And they just can't make that case. No matter how hard they try, they can't make this uniquely about Donald Trump. And a lot of people scratching their heads watching this and wondering, why are the Democrats so bizarrely obsessed with a story that is quite toxic to them? You know, why are they going so far overboard to talk about a story that hurts them as much as it hurts anybody else, maybe more? And that's the reason, because they really need to change the subject from the shutdown. There is more news coming out about things that were discovered during the shutdown. Now, I don't want to oversell this. Who knows where all this is going to go? So let's not get too excited. But in the last couple of days, we've heard from people like the Secretary of Agriculture looking into the food stamp program and discovering it was sick with fraud on a titanic scale. There were like thousands and thousands of dead people were collecting food stamps, 500,000 people collecting double food stamp payouts. It just, you know, it was a scam operation, getting rooked by fraud. And now Elon Musk has popped up. And you remember, he was the head of the Department of Government Efficiency. He was doing the big audit. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, during the shutdown, we've been doing some more studies and we found staggering levels of Social Security fraud out there, like you wouldn't believe, like billions of dollars just being heisted out of the Social Security system by fraudulent claimants, by people that have no business collecting Social Security, by people that are collecting three checks at once and all, you know, all the usual stuff like that. So Elon Musk is in the mix now. Talking about how bad the fraud was. And I wonder, and again, I don't want to oversell this, but I wonder if one of the upshots of the shutdown that maybe the Democrats didn't see coming when they shut the government down in their big power play, that's what this was. It was like an extortion racket to get money. And when they did this, I don't think they properly appreciated that while the government was quote unquote shut down, meaning, you know, stuff wasn't being funded, some activities were being canceled, that there would be auditors going over the books and starting to find a lot of the crap that's been hidden from the American people for so long about how widely abused these programs are. I think that is that's an unanticipated side effect of the government shutdown. And it's going to, again, it may not go anywhere because we've been down this road before. Sometimes people, auditors, individual senators, congressmen will come up with eye-popping reports on fraud and waste and abuse and dishonesty, and then nothing really happens. You know, like there's a story and everybody gets mad, and then nothing really changes. There's a lot of inertia surrounding these gigantic programs. And, you know, if you look at the last days of the shutdown, you can see why. Because as soon as you start talking about fixing this stuff, the agriculture secretary is basically talking about rebooting the entire food stamp program. She wants to reboot it like it was a broken computer. She wants to basically zero out every enrollee in SNAP and then make everybody enroll again so that we can finally have an honest accounting of who is and is not on food stamps. And that's a great idea from a practical standpoint. That's probably what has to happen if we're going to get this straightened out. But that is going to be mercilessly savaged by Democrats in the media if they seriously try to do this over at the Trump administration and they seriously try to just reboot the program. They're going to get destroyed in the media. And maybe they're ready for it. Maybe they'll take it. But they're going to be called insensitive and uncaring and playing political games with people's lives. And you're going to starve children and everybody needs their food stamps and so on. You know how this goes. This is one of the reasons why welfare programs have proven to be unreformable, no matter how much fraud and waste we find. And there's no surprise that Social Security is getting ripped off. We've known that for decades. But every time you start trying to fix it, you pretty much end up where the agriculture department is right now. And you say, well, the only thing to do is clear the books, get rid of the junk data, reboot this system, and get everybody re-enrolled. And when you try to do that, all hell breaks loose because you're going to be kicking people off their benefits. They won't get their food stamps. And it's a disaster. Really bad for public relations. There's a set of polls out there that show a huge amount of resistance is growing in the public over deportations. A large number of the public, I think it was like 21 or 22% support deportations as they're being done, and everybody else is a little queasy with the deportation raids. And the Catholic bishops have just written a letter where they said the deportation effort is inhuman or inhumane, and it's cruel. You're always going to run into that when you try to fix a busted, corrupt system that involves human beings and a lot of welfare and so forth being paid. As soon as you try to do anything to enforce the law or fix the problem, you're going to be called heartless and cruel. And that's exactly what's happening. I don't understand, for example, why the Catholic bishops didn't denounce Joe Biden for bringing all these people across the border and creating this mess. Remember, we had a story about all the children that Biden lost track of because he didn't care what happened to them after they successfully crossed the border, and nobody knows where they are now. Why aren't the Catholic bishops upset about that? But the only thing they ever denounce is law enforcement. So it's going to be tricky, and fixing our welfare system is going to be a big lift, and the Trump administration had better be ready for it. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Next year marks America's 250th birthday, and what better way to celebrate than an elevated train journey through the American Southwest? Canyon Spirit offers the adventure of a lifetime with scenic train journeys through rugged canyons and desert landscapes, along with gourmet dining and world-class service. Expansive panoramic windows allow guests to watch the magnificent scenery best seen by rail, including river canyons, red rocks, and more. Canyon Spirit travels between Salt Lake City and Denver with overnight stays in Moab, Utah, and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And the train only travels during the day, allowing guests to enjoy the journey and relax overnight in charming small towns. TV host and travel expert Kelly Rizzo.
I think there's a certain romance to boarding a train, especially through the iconic vistas of the Southwest. Canyon Spirit offers a front row seat to these breathtaking wonders, along with historic storytelling and regionally inspired gourmet dining. It's truly a wondrous experience.
To learn more, visit canyonspirit.com.
Butterball, the best known and most loved brand of turkey in the U.S., has partnered with renowned ChefCore brand Headley and Bennett to create the first ever Thanksgiving hosting pans. Butterball turkey talk line expert Corey Gustavik shares more.
Roasting whole turkey isn't something most of us do every day. It can be intimidating and stressful, but the right clothes can make you feel more confident and comfortable in the kitchen. That's why Butterball created the first of their kind Thanksgiving hosting pants. Designed with a fun turkey print in Butterball blue, these pants are sure to give you swagger in the kitchen while keeping all your cooking essentials within arm's reach. With custom pockets for your meat thermometer and phone, loops for your utensils and towels, and a bottle opener to keep the party hydrated, these pants will help you get a leg up in your hosting duties this year. Butterball is giving away for free one final time while supplies last at noon Eastern this Monday, November 17th.
Learn more and claim your pair of hosting pants at ThanksgivingHostingPants.com.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give him a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve, it's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned, accessible homes and vehicles, and access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at PVA.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor with Breitbart News. One of the big controversies across the country now is how law enforcement is frequently subverted by well-meaning rules or special cases that were meant to be compassionate, but instead are undermining efforts to enforce the law and to take dangerous criminals off the streets. Here with us now to talk about an example of that is Nils Gravelius, prominent Los Angeles-based private investigator, formerly of the Pinkerton Organization, best known for his investigation of the Wonderland Avenue murders, and author of the books Skulldiggery, Sub Rosa, and the upcoming The Last Lawman. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Well, good morning. How are you today?
I am doing well. This seems to me like, in a way, one of the older stories, because we've long known that special cases and special pleas for mental problems, mental issues, often get people off the hook for serious crimes. But it sounds like that's getting really bad in California.
Well, it is. And I'm going to point out that the soft science of social science is one of those things that seems to move backwards often. In other words, it gets less effective over time because of a political agenda. And there are people involved in the criminal justice processes who believe they are doing something kind, compassionate, and effective all at once. But the more cynical among them are actually playing the public. Are you familiar with the Cloward-Piven strategy?
Of course, yes, a deliberate attempt to overwhelm a system by hammering it with too many demands.
That is correct. And, the original idea of Cloward-Piven is to have citizen activists apply for benefits, apply for exemptions, apply for this and apply for that at a greater rate than government can ever meet the demand of. Well, I think this is a reverse Cloward-Piven with government activists, institutional activists, overwhelming the public to justify greater and greater taxation to handle things like dereliction, which they call homelessness, addiction, which they call homelessness, alcoholism, which they call homelessness, mental illness, which they call homelessness. And the money that they devote to this is cryptocurrency for the parasite class Democrats just below the plantation class Democrats running this state. We've created a whole class of new millionaires. All of that money goes to their pockets, and all they do is fertilize and irrigate the problem to make more of it.
So what are they exactly doing? There's a loophole out there that's letting dangerous criminals back on the streets. Tell us about that.
Well, they're not charging them with crimes. They're referring them for what's supposed to be mental health counseling. But none of the mental health counseling that they wind up in is at all effective. And the law has no provision requiring somebody to take psych meds they don't want to take. And they just land back on the streets. That's all. It's a revolving door. And these people are inventory for the social workers who, you know, whose salaries depend on this. I promise you that a plurality of these derelicts on our streets in Los Angeles vote in every election relentlessly because their ballots are harvested by the social workers who are supposed to be meeting their needs.
Well, that is one proximate effect of getting people out of jail, is that they become eligible to vote again, and they can be harvested. And your contention is this is an organized strategy that's being bankrolled deliberately.
That is absolutely true. And you and I are paying for it. It's coming right out of my pocket. We have NGOs like Churla here in Los Angeles, which are supposed to be 501c3 charities, that sort of thing. And all they are is a money laundry for the Democrat cult.
So 501c3, so people know, that's basically a charity with a tax exemption that allows them to indulge in this kind of charitable or activist work. But instead, they're being used to launder political money back into the Democratic Party's coffers.
Well, also, they're the ones placarding Los Angeles with anti-ICE posters on freeway overpasses. And they organized the Marxist riots in Los Angeles back in June to do battle with ICE and the California Highway Patrol and all of that. We paid for that. That came out of my pocket.
Well, it couldn't be more obvious. I'm glad you mentioned that. These anti-ICE protests or the No Kings demonstrations, it couldn't be more obvious that these are astroturfed, organized events with a lot of money behind them. They show up with professionally printed placards. And when they start riots, they have weapons ready to go, like loads of concrete blocks shipped in for Antifa to get their hands on. It's obvious that all of this is being organized, but that doesn't seem to have diluted their effectiveness in the public mind much. The media just doesn't report on the organization.
Well, I think you're correct, and none of this can happen without partnership with local government. You'll notice that they never publish booking photos of these people on the rare occasions when they're arrested. They don't tell you who they are, who they work for, where they go to university, what their name is, any of that. There should be a searchable database for people arrested for riot, for looting, for arson, etc., for vandalism, so that we can identify exactly whom they are and where the money comes from.
And I think I have seen suggestions that a lot of the same people are turning up at these events, and sometimes they do get arrested, and that's the headline, but then they're released, as you say, they're not booked, and we don't know it's the same person popping up over and over again.
Well, it is over and over again, and when they're called anti-ICE rioters, they're just Marxists. When they're Black Lives Matter, it's just Marxists. When it's No Kings, it's just Marxists. When it's Occupy Wall Street, it's Marxists. It's the same people over and over again. And they are incredibly apartheid. 98% of them are upper middle class white people.
It's pretty obvious that a double standard exists here, because it's hard to imagine people organizing to protest other laws. Like, let's say if there was a giant protest against income tax or against gun laws, nobody would allow them to just riot, you know, and damage and fight law enforcement officers and skip away scot-free. It would be considered a national crisis. But instead, the coverage suggests that these rioters are somehow in the right and the law enforcement personnel are in the wrong, and they're getting what's coming to them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When it occurs on the left, it's a grassroots coalition of middle class mothers, kindergarten teachers and concerned activists. When it occurs on the right, it's a pitchfork mob of semi-Klansmen.
Now, what can you do about this at a national level? California, of course, is an island unto itself, and we've seen how difficult it is for the federal government to extend its authority in there. You have other states like Illinois and Oregon that have openly defied federal authority. They're making their own rules, and it seems like there's nothing that can be done to rein them in.
Well, it can be done. Look at Harmeet Dhillon is landing on Berkeley right now for what occurred the other night at UC Berkeley. The organization that organized that riot, I think it's called By Any Means Necessary. And once again, it's a 501c3 tax exempt. And within the main political media, we keep hearing about how there's no Antifa organization, no Marxist organization. It's all spontaneous, that sort of thing. They have bank accounts. They have incorporations. They have donors. They have payrolls. And they have partners in city, county, and state government.
It sounds like the only thing we can do, really, is to start going after the money. I see some evidence that the Trump administration is doing that, and we'll have to see if those efforts bear fruit. The incident you mentioned at UC Berkeley was an outrage, and it is amazing that was permitted to happen. So we'll see if there's some consequences that stick. Nils Brevelius, prominent Los Angeles-based private investigator and authors of the books Skullduggery, Sub Rosa, and the upcoming The Last Lawman. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
Hilton has once again been ranked number one on the world's best workplace list, according to Great Place to Work and Fortune. The hospitality leader has now topped the list twice in 3 years. At Hilton, its team members say the hospitality industry is where they can learn, grow, and achieve their career goals. Victoria, a sales director at a Homewood Suites property, explains.
Hospitality is the warmest industry that you can go into. The care, the nurturing, and the areas of opportunity are large. There are so many different elements in hospitality, and I don't think everyone thinks about the larger picture that they could fit into. Hilton has always been just a welcoming, open-armed, flexible place to work. I'm going to look forward in enjoying more stable work days and the ability to just have that work-life balance that I truly want.
To learn more about what makes Hilton a great place to work, visit stories.hilton.com/world's best workplace.
Small businesses face constant security challenges, from protecting property to keeping employees and customers safe. Simply Safe is stepping in with a new suite of professional-grade security solutions designed specifically for business owners. TV host and entrepreneur Chip Wade has more.
As a business owner, I travel a lot for work, and it's reassuring to have a system that not only lets me monitor my businesses no matter where I am, but it's protected by trained agents who will intervene if there's trouble. It's about knowing my offices and workshops are protected even when I can't be there.
Simply Safe Business Security offers customizable plans backed by 24/7 monitoring. Key features include AI-powered cameras, live agents who can help prevent crimes and call for help in an emergency, multi-camera live streaming, customized user access, and elevated customer support.
Simply Safe aims to give business owners just like me peace of mind so they can focus on growing their businesses, all without long-term contracts or cancellation penalties.
To learn more, visit simplysafe.com.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show.
If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here. Probably. Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. There is a different kind of weapons of mass destruction threat beside the usual image or specter of nuclear war that defense planners have long been concerned with. It could be much easier to pull off than detonating a full-blown nuclear bomb, much harder to defend against, much harder to find the culprits, and potentially every bit as devastating. And that is an electromagnetic pulse attack. And joining us now is the man who literally wrote the book on electronic magnetic pulse attacks. He has a best-selling book called One Second After, one of the 50 books that he's written that is now being turned into a major motion picture. And he's an old friend of mine, Dr. William Forstchen. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Hey, it's good to be back. Pleasure talking with you again.
Really great to talk to you. It's been too long. This scenario of the EMP strike has haunted my imagination since the first time I saw it being discussed by defense planners. And your book is, of course, a very chilling look at what that would be like. Tell us about the EMP threat. What is it that makes this such a nightmare for defense planners?
Okay. The scenario that we developed in the 50s, 60s, 70s was full nuclear exchange. Mutual assured destruction. They fire a bunch of missiles at us. We fire a bunch of nuclear weapons back. EMP is a whole different way of playing the horrible game. It is simply created by detonating a nuclear weapon, an atomic bomb, at 250 miles out in space, which sets up an electrostatic discharge called the Compton effect. That cascades down to the Earth's surface, feeds into all our wiring. All that wiring becomes antennas, which in turn feeds that into the power grid and blows it out. The scariest part of this scenario is estimates run that 80 to 90% of all Americans would perish in the year afterwards if electricity was totally shut down across the United States.
That is the part that I think really scares people when they start reading it or seeing how you've dramatized it. It's one thing to say, oh, it would be a blackout. You know, no, it wouldn't be. Yeah. It would be devastating. And our society depends on the very technology that would be neutralized so thoroughly by a strike like this.
Well, you know, I wrote One Second After. There was a great classic in the 50s called A Last Babylon, which really laid to the American public what happens in a nuclear war. I was trying to do the same thing in 2025 with what happens in the event of an EMP. We'll call it a Maslow's hierarchy of disaster. You lose the electricity. Okay, when you got up this morning, how'd you wash?
Right, the water, which you need electric pumps for, especially in a big city.
Right then and there. The electrical pumps go down. We lose our water instantly, other than bottled water. So here it goes. Lose water immediately. Food supply. Average town only has about 20 to 25 days worth of food on hand. That's from what's in your freezer to what's in the market and pulling in the trucks. All of that goes. A lot of it requires refrigeration. So within days, it spoils. Disease breaks down. Command and control breaks down. It's a Maslow's hierarchy of disaster. In the end, people start dying in large numbers.
Now, I live in Florida, where we're accustomed to hurricanes, blackouts, having emergency food supply. But this scenario is far worse because it isn't just that the power goes down. It's that the electronics get damaged in a way that can't easily be replaced. And the cycle of restoring what was lost is not a matter of days or weeks, but months or even years. You've got a whole series of books about this, and they don't get more cheerful as they go.
But where in Florida do you live?
I live in Southwest Fort Florida on the Southwest Gulf Coast.
Okay, Naples, Fort Myers, that area?
Yeah, yep. Okay. Yep, in that area.
You got hit by a big one, I think it was about a year ago.
Yeah, a couple of years ago. It was devastating.
Well, think about all the help that came in from elsewhere. I'm in North Carolina. I'm right at the epicenter of that horrible Helene, which blew North Carolina apart a year ago. The guys who hooked me up were from Quebec. 6 weeks later, a Quebec, you know, power crew is hooking me up. We have disasters. Help comes in from all over. But suppose there's no help coming from anywhere and we're all on our own. That's the nightmare part of this. You become on your own instantly.
That is such a frightening thought. And the defense against an attack like this is really difficult. Missile defense is already a very delicate proposition. But an orbital blast like that, how do you stop that? Missile defense is almost entirely predicated on hitting the weapons as they're coming down from orbit after an ICBM glide path. If that thing's in orbit, you're never going to be able to hit it. And I've seen defense seminars where they talked about other ways to accomplish this, maybe even flying the EMP device on a dirigible or something over the middle of the country and cooking it off. I mean, how do you stop that?
But I'm finally optimistic on one point, Golden Hill. We saw this back in the spring when the Israelis were so incredibly start shooting down the Iranian missiles and such as they came in by the thousands. That's Iron Dome, which is a tactical defense system. The president is calling for a Golden Dome, which is a strategic defense system to shoot missiles down in orbit or before they get within the area of the United States. So I didn't have hope 5 years ago. I'm starting to feel a little optimistic now, thanks to Trump.
It is a good thing to think about a defense system like that. Golden Dome is a very ambitious undertaking. And you, of course, are old enough to remember the 80s, as I do, when missile defense was a fantasy. It was Star Wars. Ronald Reagan was crazy for talking about it. Were you surprised to get to something like the Israeli conflict and see just how effective the modern missile interceptors are? I mean, we could barely conceive of this stuff working though, as well as it did back in the 80s.
Leave it to Israel and the Jewish people to come up with an answer, because they have to, because they literally are on the forward edge. One mistake, major mistake, they all die, and the Holocaust is complete. So the Israelis have been working on this for years with us, and we have been working as well, starting with Iron Dome. I'm not surprised anymore. I mean, we got Mustak there as well, just landing booster systems on a daily basis. But interception point-to-point is possible, and it is being done. It is simply a bullet hitting a bullet. But when you have macro computers running these systems, it is doable, and it will get done. But it's going to, like you said, it's going to cost maybe upwards of $500 billion.
A big part of defense planning is taking an honest assessment of what you have to lose, how vulnerable you are, and how you can go about protecting it. And it seems as if one of the fears that I see echoed in stories like One Second After is that the more we've created with our spectacular technology, the more we become dependent on it. And it's now possible to imagine horrific scenarios that could be caused by even a cyber attack, even less than an EMP blast. You take away that technology we depend on, and we lose life support for these gigantic metropolises that couldn't exist otherwise very quickly.
Well, I'll throw in the five-second plug for my school, Monterey College. We have one of the finest cybersecurity programs here in the Southeast. Cybersecurity, we need 100,000 people minimum. This is what the guys in my department tell me, 100,000 trained technicians to start winning this battle. It's good hats versus the bad guys, White hats versus the black hats. Cybersecurity is a huge concern on top of everything else, and we have to protect ourselves from it. So it's a whole different, it's a new way of waging war, or as military people would say, an asymmetrical first strike capabilities to really wipe an opponent out in the first minutes of an attack.
Have you seen the stories floating around out there about the cyber attack that was conducted entirely by AI without any human intervention at all? Possibly the first time that's ever happened.
Yep. That's only the beginning.
Well, one of the scenarios that was scaring me around the time I saw EMP being discussed seriously is hyperwar, which is where the AIs and autonomous systems fight the war entirely on their own, faster than humans can monitor or even intervene. Could be physical, kinetic, could be drones, could be cyber war, artificially intelligent cyber attackers. Something like that can escalate in a matter of moments before human beings even understand what's happened.
Perhaps my next novel someday. We might very well see that the next war is fought and ended within 30 minutes. Meaning, complete. That's it. That's the entire war in 30 minutes.
That's going to be a very frightening experience for the people that get caught on the wrong end of it. Civilians,
yes,
and populations
exactly.
Have become so vulnerable. Modern warfare was never kid gloves. Warfare was always brutal. But modern warfare seems to immediately come with it a great deal of civilian damage, because civilian populations are 100% in the line of fire. They're everywhere. And the bad guys put their weapons right in the middle of civilians. It's really hard to fight a war without a lot of collateral damage, as we used to call it.
In the 18th and 19th century, Europeans and us tried to ameliorate, to make war less brutal. And one of the rules of warfare was to keep civilians out of it. The whole idea of a uniform is, person's in uniform, you shoot them. Person is not in uniform, you cannot shoot them, which gets violated a lot anyhow. But in general work, for example, us, our Americans, in World War II, in Europe, those days are over.
Yeah, it really does seem like a corner has been turned, and we don't know how the next big war is going to start, but it's a good idea to be aware of the modern technologies, the vulnerabilities. I think your book is a very approachable, very entertaining way for people to start thinking about these things, so I salute you for your accomplishments. Dr. William Forsman, professor of history and faculty fellow at Montreal College, and the author of over 50 books, including One Second After, soon to be a major motion picture. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
Would you know where to turn if you or loved one suddenly became paralyzed? Paralysis isn't something you plan for, but the National Paralysis Resource Center has served as a vital lifeline for thousands of families. But federal funding for the program is at risk. Marine veteran Sherman Gillums Jr., Senior Director of Public Policy at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, says the consequences could be devastating.
This is about more than just a budget line. It's about veterans, caregivers, and families, real people who need these resources to live more productive and independent lives.
Gillums, who lives with paralysis himself, says cutting this funding would remove critical resources like peer mentoring, help with housing, and job placement guidance.
When you take away these lifelines, people must figure out how to rebuild their lives on their own. And that's not something any family should have to do.
Learn about the importance of funding for the National Paralysis Resource Center at ChristopherReeve.org.
On Sunday, November 2nd, Americans will fall back to standard time, despite growing concerns over the health and safety risks of seasonal time changes. According to sleep experts, making standard time permanent could improve the lives of millions, and the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time and its partner, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are working to make that a reality. Dr. Karen Johnson, sleep medicine physician and co-chair of the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time.
When our schedules align with the timing of natural light, people benefit from brighter mornings, safer commutes to work and school, and improved sleep at night.
Want to lessen the effects of the time change? Try these tips. Get at least 7 hours of sleep per night before and after the change. Adjust the timing of daily routines like meals and exercise, and head out for early morning sunlight during the week after the time change. For more information about ending daylight saving time and to find additional resources about sleep disorders, treatments, and sleep health, visit sleepeducation.org, sponsored by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking, but no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart and don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
You know that feeling? Like every door is closing and you just can't see a way out? Being unemployed, underemployed, or just out of school feels a lot like that. But when you find the right tools, suddenly everything just clicks. Getting on that path may be easier than you think. A good place to start? Go to findsomethingnew.org. At findsomethingnew.org, you have access to resources that help develop new skills. Skills that will position you for careers in today's growing industries. From healthcare and manufacturing to cybersecurity and alternative energy. Plus, you can take advantage of online courses, certification programs, apprenticeships, and more. So you can take yourself from unemployed and uncertain to empowered and prepared for what's next. Find your path to a new career today. Visit findsomethingnew.org. A message from the Ad Council.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something
it's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all got to help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're going to be saving our lives.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. I want to bring you up to speed a little bit on a couple of the things that Dr. William Forstian and I were just talking about a minute ago about modern warfare and a story I mentioned that really deserves to be studied more closely. First is hyperwar. Hyperwar is an idea that has been floating around, I believe, since the early 2000s, possibly late 1990s. But really, the 2000s is when drone technology started taking off. And that's a big part of this. Hyperwar means computers do all the fighting. And you already have, you're pretty close to this, over in Ukraine, Russia. The battlefield in Ukraine has been a forest of innovations for drone warfare. Both the Ukrainians and the Russians make extensive use of drones. The Ukrainians started with a pretty significant upper hand, which is one reason the initial Russian invasion didn't work out. But then the Russians very quickly adapted, greatly expanded their own drone capabilities, and now they're one-upping each other constantly with a lot of improvised equipment. And one of the things that they both discovered is that if you want to use drones as a weapon, you need to have a way of controlling them that the enemy cannot interfere with. And it's tough if you're trying to fly a drone long range with transmitters, because those signals can be detected and jammed. So what you really want is a drone that doesn't need any more human instructions. You tell the drone, go over here, find every target, and blow it up. And the drone goes over and does it. That's a lot better than trying to control the drone with a human operator. And at a certain point in an electronic battlefield, that's the only way to do it. Can't really be piloting those things with a joystick if the enemy has low-level cover that prevents that from working. So what happens then if you have a bunch of drones that are autonomous, completely autonomous, and they're out there making battlefield decisions at an extremely high rate of speed? That's where hyperwar comes in, because machines think fast. Well, the other side's going to want their own autonomous drones too. You have to have your own autonomous weapons to keep up, to compete, to be fast enough. And the problem, the hyperwar theorists have always been afraid that at some point, two advanced combatants like Ukraine and Russia right now are going to hit each other with autonomous weapon swarms. The Ukrainians claim they've already done this at least once or twice. They sent a whole swarm over that were communicating with each other, but were not being directly controlled by human operators. And you're going to have two of those swarms fighting each other, and they're just going to start escalating. The AI is going to say, well, boy, this is serious. I need to up my game here. And the other AI is going to do the same thing. And in a matter of minutes, of seconds, this could escalate to an incredible amount of damage. And there's no way a human being can supervise this. You know, we like to think there's a person back there keeping an eye on all the drone craziness, ready to pull the plug if things get out of control. But that's not how it works. It's so fast. It happens so fast, you can't intervene. And to that end, the big story that I mentioned to Bill that I've been fascinated by this morning is what appears to be the first artificially intelligent hacker attack. That just happened, and it apparently involved Chinese nation-state hackers. Who else? I mean, if it's not China, it's North Korea. But in this case, it was China. And what they apparently did was they hacked into an artificial intelligence program made by a company called Anthropic. And Anthropic has an AI called Claude. That's the name of the AI. You know, like X has Grok and so on. Now, this is Claude. This is their product. Well, these Chinese hackers somehow managed to jailbreak Claude, which means they released all of the safety restrictions on a copy of the AI, and they repurposed it as an attack. They basically turned it into a super intelligent virus, and they used it to hit something like 30 targets around the world. And according to Anthropic, to their analysis of what happened here, Claude, the AI, did 80 to 90% of the work on this hack. So it was essentially autonomous. It was the AI doing the hacking, not people. And this is bad enough already because, you know, when human hackers do stuff, they usually drop viruses and malware into your targeted systems, and they don't really control the malware minute by minute. Usually it's designed to run wild on its own and accomplish the goals of the hacker. So we're already talking about weapons that go out of control as soon as you drop them in an enemy computer system. Well, now you have an AI that's out there hitting targets all over the world and dropping code into them and causing all kinds of havoc. And Anthropic made a point. I don't think they were bragging exactly. They're just trying to be sober here. But they made a point that their AI was acting so quickly that there was no way for human security to keep up with it. It was acting and reacting and expanding the attack so quickly, so fast, that human beings could not keep pace with the speed. And that's the hyperwar fear. And hyperwar very much can include cyber attacks. It almost certainly will. If we get into a big war, China, Russia, you know, two equal combatants of Titan scale, of U.S. world bestriding technological colossus scale, if we get into a war between two powers like that, there is absolutely going to be a massive cyber component involved. It is just too tempting not to unleash viruses on the enemy and mess up their financial system, their infrastructure, their utilities, power, water. You can hit all of that with cyber attacks without having to fire physical weapons over there. And cyber warfare is deniable. That's why China's been getting away with it all this time. Every time we catch Chinese state hackers running wild, as was the case here, the Chinese government says, well, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't have any hackers. We hate hackers. We're the worst victims of hacking in the world. The Chinese will inevitably say that every time they get caught perpetrating a major cyber attack. And how do you prove it? You know, what do you do about it? Unless you're willing to send commandos over there and raid the People's Liberation Army hacking unit number 37 in Shandong, you're never going to actually physically catch the people that are doing all this. And now you've got an AI that's actually doing the work here. And the fact that they were able to jailbreak it, which means to remove all the safety protocols, all the limits, everything that should have alerted Claude's handlers that the AI was being abused in this way, that's super scary. Because that's not supposed to be possible. And I'm sure Anthropic will now take steps to ensure it can't be done the same way again. That's, I'm sure they're working on that right now. I bet people are working overtime on that right now. But it's very scary to think how easily every rule that we've said would constrain artificial intelligence can be broken by determined hackers if they just get the data they need to make the hack. And that's bad going forward because AI is an incredibly powerful force. And long before we have to worry about living machines, you know, we're not talking about Skynet here, self-aware computers decide to kill the human race or any of that stuff. Long before we ever have to worry about something like that, we right now have to worry about artificial intelligence being able to do things at incredible speed with minimal human involvement. And that means minimal opportunities for human beings to alter the behavior of the AI. I don't know if the Chinese hackers here gave a damn what Claude was up to. They're probably just enjoying the show. But if they had wanted to intervene, if Claude had started hacking into a dangerous military target and the hacker said, whoa, boy, back off, that's too much, they couldn't. They couldn't possibly have done it because the AI was moving too fast for them to follow what it was up to. You have milliseconds to intervene and human beings don't work that fast. So that's the great fear moving forward, is that we think too slowly for the world that is to come. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor of Breitbart News, your host today. Thanks for joining us on this hour of the Alan Nathan Show.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.